Harpocrates replied. The pressure of the silence eased. I could almost breathe again without agony. Raina staggered to her feet. She helped Meg and me to stand. Unfortunately, we were not out of danger. I imagined any number of terrible things Harpocrates could do to us if we freed him. And since I'd been talking with my mind, I couldn't help but broadcast those fears. Harpocrates' glare did nothing to reassure me. The emperors must have anticipated this. They were smart, cynical, horribly logical. They knew that if I did release Harpocrates, the gods' first act would probably be to kill me. For the emperors, the potential loss of their fasces apparently didn't outweigh the potential benefit of having me destroyed, or the entertainment value of knowing I'd done it to myself. Raina touched my shoulder, making me flinch involuntarily. She and Meg had drawn their weapons. They were waiting for me to decide. Did I really want to risk this? I studied the soundless god. Do what you want with me, I thought to him. Just spare my friends. Please. His eyes burned with malice, but also a hint of glee. He seemed to be waiting for me to realize something, as if he'd written "zap me" on my backpack when I wasn't looking. Then I saw what he was holding in his lap. I hadn't noticed it while I was down on my hands and knees, but now that I was standing, it was hard to miss. A glass jar, apparently empty, sealed with a metal lid. I felt as if Tarquin had just dropped the final rock into the drowning cage around my head. I imagined the emperors howling with delight on the deck of Caligula's yacht. Rumors from centuries before swirled in my head. The Sibyl's body had crumbled away. She could not die. Her attendants kept her life force, her voice, in a glass jar. Harpocrates cradled all that remained of the Sibyl of Cumae. Another person who had every reason to hate me. A person the emperors and Tarquin knew I would feel obligated to help. They had left me the starkest of choices. Run away, let the triumvirate win, and watch my mortal friends be destroyed. Or free two bitter enemies and face the same fate as Jason Grace. It was an easy decision. I turned to Raina and Meg and thought as clearly as I could. Destroy the fasces. Cut him free. Chapter 30. A voice and a shh. I have seen stranger couples. Wait, no, I haven't. Turns out that was a bad idea. Raina and Meg moved cautiously, as one does when approaching a cornered wild animal or an angry immortal. They took up positions on either side of Harpocrates, raised their blades above the fasces, and mouthed in unison, "One, two, three!" It was almost like the fasces had been waiting to explode. Despite Raina's earlier protestations that imperial gold blades might take forever to hack through imperial gold chains, her sword and Meg's cut through the cords and cables as if they were nothing but illusions themselves. Their blades hit the fasces and shattered them, sending bundles of rods blasting into splinters, shafts breaking, golden crescents toppling to the floor. The girl stepped back, clearly surprised by their own success. Harpocrates gave me a thin, cruel smile. Without a sound, the fetters on his hands and feet cracked and fell away like spring ice. The remaining cables and chains shriveled and blackened, curling against the walls. Harpocrates stretched out his free hand, the one that was not gesturing, "Shh, I'm about to kill you," and the two golden axe blades from the broken fasces flew into his grip. His fingers turned white hot. The blades melted, gold dribbling through his fingers and pooling beneath him. A small, terrified voice in my head said, "Well, this is going great." The god plucked the glass jar from his lap. He raised it on his fingertips like a crystal ball. For a moment, I was afraid he would give it the gold axe treatment, melting whatever remained of the Sibyl just to spite me. Instead, he assaulted my mind with new images. I saw a Eurynomos lope into Harpocrates' prison, the glass jar tucked under one arm. The ghoul's mouth slavered, its eyes glowed purple. Harpocrates thrashed in his chains. It seemed he had not been in the box very long at that point. He wanted to crush the Eurynomos with silence, but the ghoul seemed unaffected. His body was being driven by another mind, far away in the tyrant's tomb. Even through telepathy, it was clear the voice was Tarquin's, heavy and brutal as chariot wheels over flesh.
"I brought you a friend," he said. "Try not to break her."
He tossed the jar to Harpocrates, who caught it out of surprise. Tarquin's possessed ghoul limped away, chuckling evilly, and chained the doors behind him. Alone in the dark, Harpocrates' first thought was to smash the jar. Anything from Tarquin had to be a trap, or poison, or something worse. But he was curious. A friend? Harpocrates had never had one of those. He wasn't sure he understood the concept. He could sense a living force inside the jar. Weak, sad, fading, but alive, and possibly more ancient than he was. He opened the lid. The faintest voice began to speak to him, cutting straight through his silence as if it didn't exist. After so many millennia, Harpocrates, the silent god who was never supposed to exist, had almost forgotten sound. He wept with joy. The god and the Sibyl began to converse. They both knew they were pawns, prisoners. They were only here because they served some purpose for the emperors and their new ally, Tarquin. Like Harpocrates, the Sibyl had refused to cooperate with her captors. She would tell them nothing of the future. Why should she? She was beyond pain and suffering. She had literally nothing left to lose and longed only to die. Harpocrates shared the feeling. He was tired of spending millennia slowly wasting away, waiting until he was obscure enough, forgotten by all humankind, so he could cease to exist altogether. His life had always been bitter, a never-ending parade of disappointments, bullying, and ridicule. Now he wanted sleep, the eternal sleep of extinct gods. They shared stories. They bonded over their hatred of me. They realized that Tarquin wanted this to happen. He had thrown them together hoping they'd become friends, so he could use them as leverage against each other. But they couldn't help their feelings. "Wait," I interrupted Harpocrates' story. "Are you two together?" I shouldn't have asked. I didn't mean to send such an incredulous thought. Like, how does a shh god fall in love with a voice in a glass jar? Harpocrates' rage pressed down on me, making my knees buckle. The air pressure increased, as if I'd plummeted 1,000 feet. I almost blacked out, but I guessed Harpocrates wouldn't let that happen. He wanted me conscious, able to suffer. He flooded me with bitterness and hate. My joints began to unknit, my vocal cords dissolving. Harpocrates might have been ready to die, but that didn't mean he wouldn't kill me first. That would bring him great satisfaction. I bowed my head, gritting my teeth against the inevitable. Fine, I thought. I deserve it. Just spare my friends. Please. The pressure eased. I glanced up through a haze of pain. In front of me, Reyna and Meg stood shoulder to shoulder, facing down the god. They sent him their own flurry of images. Reyna pictured me singing the fall of Jason Grace to the Legion, officiating at Jason's funeral pyre with tears in my eyes, then looking goofy and awkward and clueless as I offered to be her boyfriend, giving her the best, most cleansing laugh she'd had in years. Thanks, Reyna. Meg pictured the way I'd saved her in the Myrmica's lair at Camp Half-Blood, singing about my romantic failures with such honesty it rendered giant ants catatonic with depression. She envisioned my kindness to Livia the elephant, to Crest, and especially to her, when I'd given her a hug in our room at the cafe and told her I would never give up trying. In all their memories, I looked so human, but in the best possible ways. Without words, my friends asked Harpocrates if I was still the person he hated so much. The gods scowled, considering the two young women. Then a small voice spoke, actually spoke, from inside the sealed glass jar. Enough. As faint and muffled as her voice was, I should not have been able to hear it. Only the utter silence of the shipping container made her audible. Though how she cut through Harpocrates's dampening field, I had no idea. It was definitely the Sibyl. I recognized her defiant tone, the same way she'd sounded centuries before, when she vowed never to love me until every grain of sand ran out. Come back to me at the end of that time. Then, if you still want me, I'm yours. Now, here we were, at the wrong end of forever, neither of us in the right form to choose the other. Harpocrates regarded the jar, his expression turning sad and plaintive. He seemed to ask, "Are you sure?" "This is what I have foreseen," whispered the Sibyl. "At last, we will rest." A new image appeared in my mind. Verses from the Sibylline books. Purple letters against white skin so bright it made me squint. The words smoked as if fresh from a harpy tattoo artist's needle. Add the last breath of the god who speaks not. Once his soul is cut free, together with the shattered glass. Harpocrates must have seen the words too, judging from the way he winced. I waited for him to process their meaning, to get angry again, to decide that if anyone's soul should be cut free, it should be mine. When I was a god, I rarely thought about the passage of time. A few centuries here or there, what did it matter? Now I considered just how long ago the Sibyl had written those lines. They had been scribbled into the original Sibylline books, back when Rome was still a puny kingdom. Had the Sibyl known even then what they meant? Had she realized she would end up as nothing but a voice in a jar, stuck in this dark metal box with her boyfriend who smelled like roses and looked like a withered 10-year-old in a toga and a bowling pin crown? If so, how could she not want to kill me even more than Harpocrates did? The god peered into the container, maybe having a private telepathic conversation with his beloved Sibyl. Reyna and Meg shifted, doing their best to block me from the god's line of sight. Perhaps they thought if he couldn't see me, he might forget I was there. I felt awkward peeking around their legs, but I was so drained and lightheaded I doubted I could stand. No matter what images Harpocrates had shown me, or how weary he was of life, I couldn't imagine he would just roll over and surrender. Oh, you need to kill me for your prophecy thingy? Okay, sure. Stab me right here. I definitely couldn't imagine him letting us take the Sibyl's jar and shattering it for our summoning ritual. They had found love. Why would they want to die? Finally, Harpocrates nodded, as if they'd come to an agreement. His face tightening with concentration, he pulled his index finger from his mouth, lifted the jar to his lips, and gave it a gentle kiss. Normally, I would not have been moved by a man caressing a jar, but the gesture was so sad and heartfelt, a lump formed in my throat. He twisted off the lid.
Goodbye, Apollo,
said the Sibyl's voice, clearer now.
I forgive you, not because you deserve it, not for your sake at all, but because I will not go into oblivion carrying hate when I can carry love.
Even if I could have spoken, I wouldn't have known what to say. I was in shock. Her tone asked for no reply, no apology. She didn't need or want anything from me. It was almost as if I were the one being erased. Harpocrates met my gaze. Resentment still smoldered in his eyes, but I could tell he was trying to let it go. The effort seemed even harder for him than keeping his hand from his mouth. Without meaning to, I asked, "Why are you doing this? How can you just agree to die?" It was in my interest that he did so, sure, but it made no sense. He had found another soul to live for. Besides, too many other people had already sacrificed themselves for my quests. I understood now, better than I ever had, why dying was sometimes necessary. As a mortal, I had made that choice just a few minutes ago in order to save my friends. But a god agreeing to cease his existence, especially when he was free and in love? No. I couldn't comprehend that. Harpocrates gave me a dry smirk. My confusion, my sense of near panic must have given him what he needed to finally stop being angry at me. Of the two of us, he was the wiser god. He understood something I did not. He certainly wasn't going to give me any answers. The soundless god sent me one last image. Me at an altar, making a sacrifice to the heavens. I interpreted that as an order. Make this worth it. Don't fail. Then he exhaled deeply. We watched, stunned, as he began to crumble, his face cracking, his crown collapsing like a sandcastle turret. His last breath, a silver glimmer of fading life force, swirled into the glass jar to be with the Sibyl. He had just enough time to twist the lid closed before his arms and chest turned to chunks of dust. And then Harpocrates was gone. Reyna lunged forward, catching the jar before it could hit the floor.
That was close, she said,
which was how I realized the god's silence had been broken. Everything seemed too loud. My own breathing, the sizzle of severed electrical wires, the creaking of the container's walls in the wind. Meg still had the skin tone of a legume. She stared at the jar in Reyna's hand as if worried it might explode.
Are they? I think.
I choked on my words. I dabbed my face and found my cheeks were wet.
I think they're gone.
Permanently. Harpocrates' last breath is all that remains in the jar now. Reyna peered through the glass.
But the Sibyl,
She turned to face me and almost dropped the jar. My gods, Apollo. You look terrible. A horror show. Yes, I remember. No. I mean, it's worse now. The infection. When did that happen? Meg squinted at my face. Oh, yuck. We gotta get you healed. Quick. I was glad I didn't have a mirror or a phone camera to see how I looked. I could only assume the lines of purple infection had made their way up my neck and were now drawing fun new patterns on my cheeks. I didn't feel any more zombie-ish. My stomach wound didn't throb any worse than before. But that could have simply meant my nervous system was shutting down. Help me up, please, I said. It took both of them to do so. In the process, I put one hand on the floor to brace myself. Amid the shattered fasces rods, and got a splinter in my palm. Of course I did. I wobbled on spongy legs, leaning on Reyna, then on Meg, trying to remember how to stand. I didn't want to look at the glass jar, but I couldn't help it. There was no sign of Harpocrates' silvery life force inside. I had to have faith that his last breath was still there. Either that, or when we tried to do our summoning, I would discover that he had played a terrible final joke on me. As for the Sibyl, I couldn't sense her presence. I was sure her final grain of sand had slipped away. She had chosen to exit the universe with Harpocrates. One last shared experience between two unlikely lovers. On the outside of the jar, the gluey remains of a paper label clung to the glass. I could just make out the faded words, Smucker's Grape. Tarquin and the Emperors had much to answer for. How could they? Reyna shivered. Can a god do that? Just choose to stop existing? I wanted to say, gods can do anything. But the truth was, I didn't know. The bigger question was, why would a god even want to try? When Harpocrates had given me that last dry smile, had he been hinting that someday I might understand? Someday would even the Olympians be forgotten relics, yearning for non-existence? I used my nails to pull the splinter from my palm. Blood pooled. Regular, red human blood. It ran down the groove of my lifeline, which was not a great omen. Good thing I didn't believe in such things. We need to get back, Reyna said. Can you move? Shh, Meg interrupted, putting a finger to her lips. I feared she was doing the most inappropriate Harpocrates impersonation ever. Then I realized she was quite serious. My newly sensitive ears picked up on what she was hearing. The faint, distant cries of angry birds. The ravens were returning. Chapter 31. Oh, blood moon rising. Take a rain check on doomsday. I'm stuck in traffic. We emerged from the shipping container just in time to get dive-bombed. A raven swooped past Reyna and bit a chunk out of her hair. Ow! She yelled. All right, that's it. Hold this. She shoved the glass jar into my hands, then readied her sword. A second raven came within range, and she slashed it out of the sky. Meg's twin blades whirled, Vitamixing another bird into a black cloud. That left only 30 or 40 more bloodthirsty hang gliders of doom swarming the tower. Anger swelled in me. I decided I was done with the raven's bitterness. Plenty of folks had valid reasons to hate me. Harpocrates, the Sibyl, Coronis, Daphne, maybe a few dozen others. Okay, maybe a few hundred others. But the ravens? They were thriving. They'd grown gigantic. They loved their new jobs as flesh-eating killers. Enough with the blame. I secured the glass jar in my backpack. Then I unslung the bow from my shoulder. "Scram or die," I yelled at the birds. "You get one warning." The ravens cawed and croaked with derision. One dove at me and got an arrow between the eyes. It spiraled downward, shedding a funnel cloud of feathers. I picked another target and shot it down, then a third and a fourth. The ravens' cause became cries of alarm. They widened their circle, probably thinking they could get out of range. I proved them wrong. I kept shooting until 10 were dead, then a dozen. "I brought extra arrows today," I shouted. "Who wants the next one?" At last, the birds got the message. With a few parting screeches, probably unprintable comments about my parentage, they broke off their assault and flew north toward Marin County.
"Nice work," Meg told me, retracting her blades.
The best I could manage was a nod and some wheezing. Beads of sweat froze on my forehead. My legs felt like soggy French fries. I didn't see how I could climb back down the ladder, much less race off for a fun-filled evening of god summoning, combat to the death, and possibly turning into a zombie. Oh, gods. Raina stared in the direction the flock had gone, her fingers absently exploring her scalp where the raven had snapped off a hunk of her hair.
"It'll grow back," I said.
"What? No, not my hair. Look." She pointed to the Golden Gate Bridge. We must have been inside the shipping container much longer than I'd realized. The sun sat low in the western sky. The daytime full moon had risen above Mount Tamalpais. The afternoon heat had burned away all the fog, giving us a perfect view of the White Fleet. 50 beautiful yachts in V formation, gliding leisurely past Point Bonita Lighthouse at the edge of the Marin Headlands, making their way toward the bridge. Once past it, they would have smooth sailing into the San Francisco Bay. My mouth tasted like god dust. "How long do we have?" Raina checked her watch. "The Vape are taking their time, but even at the rate they're sailing, they'll be in position to fire on the camp by sunset. Maybe 2 hours." Under different circumstances, I might have enjoyed her use of the term Vape. It had been a long time since I'd heard someone call their enemies spoiled wines. In modern parlance, the closest meaning would have been scumbags. "How long will it take for us to reach camp?" I asked. "In Friday afternoon traffic?" Raina calculated. "A little more than 2 hours." From one of her gardening belt pouches, Meg pulled a fistful of seeds.
"I guess we better hurry then."
I was not familiar with Jack and the Beanstalk. It didn't sound like a proper Greek myth. When Meg said we'd have to use a Jack and the Beanstalk exit, I didn't have a clue what she meant, even as she scattered handfuls of seeds down the nearest pylon, causing them to explode into bloom until she'd formed a latticework of plant matter all the way to the ground.
"Over you go," she ordered. "But you're in no shape to climb the ladder," she said. "This'll be faster. Like falling, only with plants."
I hated that description. Raina just shrugged. "What the heck?" She kicked one leg over the railing and jumped. The plants grabbed her, passing her down the leafy latticework a few feet at a time, like a bucket brigade. At first, she yelped and flailed her arms, but about halfway to the ground, she shouted up to us,
"Not that bad!"
I went next. It was bad. I screamed. I got flipped upside down. I floundered for something to hold on to, but I was completely at the mercy of creepers and ferns. It was like free-falling through a skyscraper-sized bag of leaves, if those leaves were still alive and very touchy-feely. At the bottom, the plants set me down gently on the grass next to Raina, who looked like she'd been tarred and flowered. Meg landed beside us and immediately crumpled into my arms.
"Lot of plants," she muttered.
Her eyes rolled up in her head. She began to snore. I guessed she would not be jacking any more beanstalks today. Aurum and Argentum bounded over, wagging their tails and yapping. The hundreds of black feathers strewn around the parking lot told me the greyhounds had been having fun with the birds I'd shot out of the sky. I was in no condition to walk, much less carry Meg. But somehow, dragging her between us, Raina and I managed to stumble back down the hillside to the truck. I suspected Raina was using her balloon-amazing skills to lend me some of her strength, though I doubted she had much left to spare. When we reached the Chevy, Raina whistled. Her dogs jumped into the back. We wrestled our unconscious beanstalk master into the middle of the bench seat. I collapsed next to her. Raina cranked the ignition, and we tore off down the hill. Our progress was great for about 90 seconds. Then we hit the Castro District and got stuck in Friday traffic funneling toward the highway. It was almost enough to make me wish for another bucket brigade of plants that could toss us back to Oakland. After our time with Harpocrates, everything seemed obscenely loud. The Chevy's engine, the chatter of passing pedestrians, the thrum of subwoofers from other cars. I cradled my backpack, trying to take comfort in the fact that the glass jar was intact. We had gotten what we came for, though I could hardly believe the Sybil and Harpocrates were gone. I would have to process my shock and grief later, assuming I lived. I needed to figure out a way to properly honor their passing. How did one commemorate the death of a god of silence? A moment of silence seemed superfluous. Perhaps a moment of screaming? First things first, survive tonight's battle. Then I would figure out the screaming. Raina must have noticed my worried expression. "You did good back there," she said. "You stepped up." Raina sounded sincere, but her praise just made me feel more ashamed. "I'm holding the last breath of a god I bullied," I said miserably. "In the jar of a Sybil I cursed, who was protected by birds I turned into killing machines after they tattled about my cheating girlfriend, who I subsequently had assassinated." "All true," Raina said. "But the thing is, you recognize it now. It feels horrible." She gave me a thin smile. "That's kind of the point. You do something evil, you feel bad about it, you do better. That's a sign you might be developing a conscience." I tried to remember which of the gods had created the human conscience. Had we created it? Or had humans just developed it on their own? Giving mortals a sense of decency didn't seem like the sort of thing a god would brag about on their profile page. I appreciate what you're saying," I managed. "But my past mistakes almost got you and Meg killed. If Harpocrates had destroyed you when you were trying to protect me..." The idea was too awful to contemplate. My shiny new conscience would have blown up inside me like a grenade. Raina gave me a brief pat on the shoulder. "All we did was show Harpocrates how much you've changed. He recognized it. Have you completely made up for all the bad things you've done?" "No. But you keep adding to the good things column. That's all any of us can do." Adding to the good things column. Raina spoke of this superpower as if it were one I could actually possess. "Thank you," I said. She studied my face with concern, probably noting how far the purple vines of infection had wriggled their way across my cheeks. "You can thank me by staying alive, okay? We need you for that summoning ritual." As we climbed the entrance ramp to Interstate 80, I caught glimpses of the bay beyond the downtown skyline. The yachts had now slipped under the Golden Gate Bridge. Apparently, the cutting of Harpocrates' cords and the destruction of the fasces hadn't deterred the emperors at all. Stretching out in front of the big vessels were silver wake lines from dozens of smaller boats making their way toward the East Bay shoreline. Landing parties, I guessed. And those boats were moving a whole lot faster than we were. Over Mount Tam, the full moon rose, slowly turning the color of Dakota's Kool-Aid. Meanwhile, Orem and Argentum barked cheerfully in the truck bed. Reyna drummed her fingers on the steering wheel and murmured, "Vamanos, vamanos." Meg leaned against me, snoring and drooling on my shirt, because she loved me so much. We were inching our way onto the Bay Bridge when Reyna finally said, "I can't stand this. The ships shouldn't have made it past the Golden Gate." "What do you mean?" I asked. "Open the glove compartment, please. Should be a scroll inside." I hesitated. Who knew what sort of dangers might lurk in the glove compartment of a Praetor's pickup truck? Cautiously, I rummaged past her insurance documents, a few packages of tissues, some baggies of dog treats. "This?" I held up a floppy cylinder of vellum. "Yeah, unroll it and see if it works." "You mean it's a communication scroll?" She nodded. "I do it myself, but it's dangerous to drive and scroll." Okay. I spread the vellum across my lap. Its surface appeared blank. Nothing happened. I wondered if I was supposed to say some magic words or give it a credit card number or something. Then, above the scroll, a faint ball of light flickered, slowly resolving into a miniature, holographic Frank Zhang.
Whoa!
Tiny Frank nearly jumped out of his tiny armor.
"Apollo?"
"Hi," I said. Then to Reyna, "It works." "I see that," she said. "Frank, can you hear me?" Frank squinted. We must have looked tiny and fuzzy to him, too.
"Is that? Can barely...
Reyna?" "Yes," she said. "We're on our way back. The ships are incoming."
"I know. Scouts report."
Frank's voice crackled. He seemed to be in some sort of large cave, legionnaires hustling behind him, digging holes and carrying large urns of some kind. "What are you doing?" Reyna asked. "Where are you?"
"Caldecott," Frank said. "Just defensive stuff."
I wasn't sure if his voice fuzzed out that time because of static or if he was being evasive. Judging from his expression, we'd caught him at an awkward moment.
"Any word, Michael?"
he asked, definitely changing the subject.
"Should have by now."
"What?" Reyna asked, loud enough to make Meg snort in her sleep. "No, I was going to ask if you'd heard anything. They were supposed to stop the yachts at the Golden Gate, since the ships cut through." Her voice faltered. There could have been a dozen reasons why Michael Cahale and his commando team had failed to stop the Emperor's yachts. None of them were good. And none of them could change what would happen next. The only things now standing between Camp Jupiter and fiery annihilation were the Emperor's pride, which made them insist on making a ground assault first and an empty Smucker's jelly jar that might or might not allow us to summon godly help. "Just hang on," Reyna said. "Tell Ella to get things ready for the ritual."
"Can't... what?"
Frank's face melted to a smudge of colored light. His voice sounded like gravel shaking in an aluminum can.
"I... Hazel... need to..."
The scroll burst into flames, which was not what my crotch needed at that particular moment. I swatted the cinders off my pants as Meg woke, yawning and blinking.
What did you do?
She demanded.
Nothing.
I didn't know the message would self-destruct. Bad connection, Raina guessed. The silence must be breaking up slowly, like working its way outward from the epicenter at Sutro Tower. We overheated the scroll.
That's possible.
I stomped out the last bits of smoldering vellum. Hopefully we'll be able to send an iris message once we reach camp. If we reach camp, Raina grumbled.
This traffic.
Oh. She pointed to a blinking road sign ahead of us. Highway 24 East closed at Caldecott Tunnel for emergency maintenance. Seek alternate routes.
Emergency maintenance?
Said Meg.
You think it's the mist again, clearing people out?
Maybe. Raina frowned at the lines of cars in front of us. No wonder everything's backed up. What was Frank doing in the tunnel? We didn't discuss any.
She knit her eyebrows, as if an unpleasant thought had occurred to her.
We have to get back, fast. The Emperors will need time to organize their ground assault, I said. They won't launch their ballistae until after they've tried to take the camp intact. Maybe. Maybe the traffic will slow them down too. They'll have to seek alternate routes.
They're on boats, dummy, said Meg.
She was right. And once the assault forces landed, they'd be marching on foot, not driving.
Still,
I liked the image of the Emperors and their army approaching the Caldecott Tunnel, seeing a bunch of flashing signs and orange cones, and deciding, well, darn, we'll have to come back tomorrow.
We could ditch the truck, Raina mused. Then she glanced at us and clearly dismissed the idea.
None of us was in any shape to run a half marathon from the middle of the Bay Bridge to Camp Jupiter. She muttered a curse.
We need... Ah!
Just ahead, a maintenance truck was trundling along. A worker on the tailgate, picking up cones that had been blocking the left lane for some unknown reason. Typical. Friday at rush hour, with the Caldecott Tunnel shut down, obviously what you wanted to do was close one lane of traffic on the area's busiest bridge. This meant, however, that ahead of the maintenance truck, there was an empty, extremely illegal to drive in lane that stretched as far as the Lester could see.
Hold on, Raina warned.
And as soon as we edged past the maintenance truck, she swerved in front of it, plowing down a half dozen cones and gunned the engine. The maintenance truck blared its horn and flashed its headlights. Raina's greyhounds barked and wagged their tails in reply, like, see ya. I imagined we would have a few California Highway Patrol vehicles ready to chase us at the bottom of the bridge, but for the time being, we blasted past traffic at speeds that would have been creditable even for my Sun Chariot. We reached the Oakland side. Still no sign of pursuit. Raina veered onto 580, smashing through a line of orange delineator posts and rocketing up the merge ramp for Highway 24. She politely ignored the guys in hard hats who waved their orange danger signs and screamed things at us. We had found our alternate route. It was the regular route we weren't supposed to take. I glanced behind us. No cops yet. Out in the water, the Emperor's yachts had passed Treasure Island and were leisurely taking up positions, forming a necklace of billion-dollar luxury death machines across the bay. I saw no trace of the smaller landing craft, which meant they must have reached the shore. That wasn't good. On the bright side, we were making great time. We soared along the overpass all by ourselves, our destination only a few miles away.
We're going to make it, I said,
like a fool. Once again, I had broken the first law of Percy Jackson, Never say something is going to work out, because as soon as you do, it won't.
Kalump!
Above our heads, foot-shaped indentations appeared in the truck's ceiling. The vehicle lurched under the extra weight. It was Deja Ghoul all over again. Orim and Argentum barked wildly.
Euronymous!
Meg yelled.
Where do they come from?
I complained. Do they just hang around on highway signs all day, waiting to drop? Claws punctured the metal and upholstery. I knew what would happen next. Skylight installation. Reyna shouted, Apollo, take the wheel! Meg, gas pedal! For a heartbeat, I thought she meant that as some kind of prayer. In moments of personal crisis, my followers often used to implore me, Apollo, take the wheel, hoping I would guide them through their problems. Most of the time, though, they didn't mean it literally. Nor was I physically sitting in the passenger seat, nor did they add anything about Meg and gas pedals. Reyna didn't wait for me to figure it out. She released her grip and reached behind her seat, groping for a weapon. I lunged across and grabbed the wheel. Meg put her foot on the accelerator. Quarters were much too close for Reyna to use her sword, but that didn't bother her. Reyna had daggers. She unsheathed one, glared at the roof bending and breaking above us, and muttered, "Nobody messes with my truck." A lot happened in the next 2 seconds. The roof ripped open, revealing the familiar, disgusting sight of a fly-colored Euronymous, its white eyes bulging, its fangs dripping with saliva, its vulture feather loincloth fluttering in the wind. The smell of rancid meat wafted into the cab, making my stomach turn. All the zombie poison in my system seemed to ignite at once. The Euronymous screamed, "Foo!" Its battle cry was cut short, however, when Reyna launched herself upward and impaled her dagger straight up its vulture diaper. She'd apparently been studying the weak spots of the ghouls. She had found one. The Euronymous toppled off the truck, which would have been wonderful, except that I, too, felt like I had been stabbed in the diaper. I said, "Glurg." My hand slipped off the wheel. Meg hit the accelerator in alarm. With Reyna still half out of the cab, her greyhounds howling furiously, our Chevy veered across the ramp and crashed straight through the guardrail. Lucky me. Once again, I went flying off an East Bay highway in a car that couldn't fly. Chapter 32. We have a special today on Slightly Used Trucks. Thanks, Target shoppers. My son Asclepius once explained the purpose of physical shock to me. He said it's a safety mechanism for coping with trauma. When the human brain experiences something too violent and frightening to process, it just stops recording. Minutes, hours, even days can be a complete blank in the victim's memory. Perhaps this explained why I had no recollection of the Chevy crashing. After hurtling through the guardrail, the next thing I remembered was stumbling around the parking lot of a Target store, pushing a three-wheeled shopping cart filled with Meg. I was muttering the lyrics to Sittin' on the Dock of the Bay. Meg, semi-conscious, was listlessly waving one hand, trying to conduct. My cart bumped into a steaming, crumpled heap of metal. A red Chevy Silverado with its tires popped, its windshield broken, and its airbags deployed. Some inconsiderate driver had plummeted from the heavens and landed right on top of the cart return, smashing a dozen shopping carts beneath the weight of the pickup. Who would do such a thing? Wait. I heard growling. A few car lengths away, two metal greyhounds stood protectively over their wounded master, keeping a small crowd of spectators at bay. A young woman in maroon and gold. Right, I remembered her. She liked to laugh at me. Was propped on her elbows, grimacing mightily. Her left leg bent at an unnatural angle. Her face was the same color as the asphalt.
Reyna!
I wedged Meg's shopping cart against the truck and ran to help the Praetor. Aurum and Argentum let me through.
Oh, oh, oh.
I couldn't seem to say anything else. I should have known what to do. I was a healer. But that break in the leg, yikes.
I'm alive,
Reyna said through gritted teeth.
Meg?
She's conducting, I said. One of the Target shoppers inched forward, braving the fury of the dogs.
I called 911. Is there anything else I can do?
She'll be fine,
I yelped.
Thank you. I'm
a doctor? The mortal woman blinked.
Are you asking me?
No, I'm a doctor. Hey, said a second shopper. Your other friend is rolling away.
Ack!
I ran after Meg, who was muttering, "Wee!" as she picked up steam in her red plastic cart. I grabbed the handles and navigated her back to Reyna's side. The Praetor tried to move, but choked on the pain.
I might black out.
No, no, no!
Think, Apollo, think.
Should I wait for the mortal paramedics, who knew nothing of ambrosia and nectar? Should I check for more first aid supplies in Meg's gardening belt? A familiar voice from across the parking lot yelled,
Thank you, everybody. We'll take it from here.
Lavinia Asimov jogged toward us, a dozen naiads and fawns in her wake, many of whom I recognized from People's Park. Most were dressed in camouflage, covered with vines and branches like they had just arrived via beanstalk. Lavinia wore pink camo pants and a green tank top, her Manu Ballista clanking against her shoulder. With her spiky pink hair and pink eyebrows, her jaw working furiously on a wad of bubblegum, she just radiated authority figure.
This is now an active investigation scene, she announced to the mortals. Thank you, Target shoppers. Please move along.
Either the tone of her voice or the barking of the greyhounds finally convinced the onlookers to disperse. Nevertheless, sirens were blaring in the distance. Soon we'd be surrounded by paramedics or the highway patrol, or both. Mortals weren't nearly as used to vehicles hurtling off highway overpasses as I was. We stared at our pink-haired friend.
Lavinia, what are you doing here?
Secret mission, she announced.
That's Kakaseka,
Reyna grumbled.
You left your post. You're in so much trouble.
Lavinia's nature spirit friends looked jumpy, like they were on the verge of scattering. But their pink-frosted leader calmed them with a glance. Reyna's greyhounds didn't snarl or attack, which I guessed meant they detected no lies from Lavinia.
All due respect, Praetor, she said, but it looks like you're in more trouble than I am at the moment. Harold, Felipe, stabilize her leg and let's get her out of this parking lot before more mortals arrive. Reginald, push Meg's cart. Latoya, retrieve whatever supplies they have in the truck, please. I'll help Apollo. We'll make for those woods. Now!
Lavinia's definition of woods was generous. I would have called it a gully where shopping carts went to die. Still, her People's Park platoon worked with surprising efficiency. In a matter of minutes, they had us all safely hidden in the ditch, among the broken carts and trash-festooned trees, just as emergency vehicles came wailing into the parking lot. Harold and Felipe splinted Reyna's leg, which only caused her to scream and throw up a little. Two other fauns constructed a stretcher for her out of branches and old clothing, while Aurum and Argentum tried to help by bringing them sticks. Or perhaps they just wanted to play fetch. Reginald extricated Meg from her shopping cart and revived her with hand-fed bits of ambrosia. A couple of dryads checked me for injuries, meaning even more injuries than I'd had before, but there wasn't much they could do. They didn't like the look of my zombie-infected face, or the way the undead infection made me smell. Unfortunately, my condition was beyond any nature spirit healing. As they moved off, one muttered to her friend,
"Once it gets fully dark."
"I know," said her friend. "With a blood moon tonight, poor guy."
I decided to ignore them. It seemed the best way to avoid bursting into tears. Latoya, who must have been a redwood dryad, judging from her burgundy complexion and impressive size, crouched next to me and deposited all the supplies she'd retrieved from the truck. I grabbed frantically, not for my bow and quiver, or even my ukulele, but for my backpack. I almost fainted with relief when I found the Smucker's jar inside, still intact.
"Thank you," I told her.
She nodded somberly.
"A good jelly jar is hard to find."
Reyna struggled to sit up among the fawns fussing over her.
"We're wasting time. We have to get back to camp."
Lavinia arched her pink eyebrows. "You're not going anywhere with that leg, Praetor. Even if you could, you wouldn't be much help. We can heal you faster if you just relax."
"Relax? The Legion needs me. It needs you too, Lavinia. How could you desert?"
"Okay, first I didn't desert. You don't know all the facts."
"You left camp without leave. You—"
Reyna leaned forward too fast and gasped in agony. The fawns took her shoulders. They helped her to sit back, easing her onto the new stretcher with its lovely padding of moss, trash, and old tie-dyed t-shirts.
"You left your comrades," Reyna croaked. "Your friends."
"I'm right here," Lavinia said. "I'm going to ask Felipe to lull you to sleep now so you can rest and heal."
"No, you can't run away."
Lavinia snorted. "Who said anything about running away? Remember, Reyna, this was your backup plan. Plan L for Lavinia. When we all get back to camp, you're going to thank me. You'll tell everybody this was your idea."
"What? I would never. I didn't give you any such. This is mutiny."
I glanced at the greyhounds, waiting for them to rise to their master's defense and tear Lavinia apart. Strangely, they just kept circling Reyna, occasionally licking her face or sniffing her broken leg. They seemed concerned about her condition, but not at all about Lavinia's rebellious lies.
"Lavinia," Reyna pleaded, "I'll have to bring you up on desertion charges. Don't do this. Don't make me—"
"Now, Felipe,"
Lavinia ordered. The fawn raised his panpipes and played a lullaby, soft and low, right next to Reyna's head.
"Can't."
Reyna struggled to keep her eyes open.
"Won't. Ah."
She went limp and began to snore.
"That's better."
Lavinia turned to me. "Don't worry. I'll leave her someplace safe with a couple of fawns. And of course, Aurum and Argentum. She'll be taken care of while she heals. You and Meg, do what you need to do." Her confident stance and her take-charge tone made her almost unrecognizable as the gawky, nervous legionnaire we'd met at Lake Temescal. She reminded me more of Reyna now, and of Meg. Mostly, though, she seemed like a stronger version of herself. A Lavinia who had decided what she needed to do and would not rest until she did it.
"Where are you going?"
I asked, still utterly confused. Why won't you come back to camp with us?
Meg stumbled over, ambrosia crumbles stuck around her mouth.
Don't pester her, she told me.
Then to Lavinia.
Is Peaches?
Lavinia shook her head. He and Don are with the advance group, making contact with the Nereids. Meg pouted.
Yeah, okay.
The Emperor's ground forces? Lavinia's expression turned somber. They already passed by. We hid and watched.
Yeah, it's not good.
I'm sure they'll be in combat with the Legion by the time you get there. You remember the path I told you about?
Yeah,
Meg agreed.
Okay, good luck.
Whoa, whoa, whoa. I tried to make a timeout sign, though my uncoordinated hands made it look more like a tent.
What are you talking about? What path? Why would you come out here just to hide as the enemy army passes by? Why are Peaches and Don talking to...
Wait, Nereids? Nereids are spirits of the sea. The nearest ones would be... Oh. I couldn't see much from our trash-filled gully. I definitely couldn't see the San Francisco Bay or the string of yachts taking up position to fire on the camp. But I knew we were close. I looked at Lavinia with newfound respect. Or disrespect. Which is it when you realize that someone you knew was crazy is actually even crazier than you suspected? Lavinia. You're not planning.
Stop right there, she warned, or I'll have Felipe put you down for a nap, too.
But Michael Cahale.
Yeah, we know.
He failed. The Emperor's troops were bragging about it as they marched past. It's one more thing they have to pay for. Brave words, but her eyes betrayed a flicker of worry, telling me she was more terrified than she let on. She was having trouble keeping up her own courage and preventing her makeshift troops from losing their nerve. She did not need me reminding her how insane her plan was.
We've all got a lot to do, she said. Good luck. She ruffled Meg's hair,
which did not need any more ruffling.
Dryads and fauns, let's move!
Harold and Felipe picked up Reyna's makeshift stretcher and jogged off down the gully. Aurum and Argentum bounding around them like, oh boy, another hike! Lavinia and the others followed. Soon they were lost in the underbrush, vanishing into the terrain as only nature spirits and girls with bright pink hair can do. Meg studied my face.
You whole?
I almost wanted to laugh. Where had she picked up that expression? I had zombie poison coursing through my body and up into my face. The dryads thought I would turn into a shambling undead minion of Tarquin as soon as it got fully dark. I was shaking from exhaustion and fear. We apparently had an enemy army between us and camp, and Lavinia was leading a suicide attack on the Imperial fleet with inexperienced nature spirits, when an actual elite commando force had already failed. When had I last felt whole? I wanted to believe it was back when I was a god, but that wasn't true. I hadn't been completely myself for centuries, maybe millennia. At the moment, I felt more like a whole, a void in the cosmos through which Harpocrates, the Sibyl, and a lot of people I cared about had vanished.
I'll manage, I said. Good. Because look.
Meg pointed toward the Oakland Hills. I thought I was seeing fog, but fog didn't rise vertically from hillsides. Close to the perimeter of Camp Jupiter, fires were burning.
We need wheels, said Meg.
Chapter 33. Welcome to the war. We hope you enjoy your death. Please come again soon.
Okay, but why did it have to be bicycles?
I understood that cars were a deal breaker. We had crashed enough vehicles for 1 week. I understood that jogging to camp was out of the question, given the fact that we could barely stand.
But why didn't demigods have some sort of rideshare app for summoning giant eagles?
I decided I would create one as soon as I became a god again. Right after I figured out a way to let demigods use smartphones safely. Across the street from Target stood a rack of canary yellow Go-Glow bikes. Meg inserted a credit card into the kiosk. Where she got the card, I had no idea. Freed two cycles from the rack and offered one to me.
Joy and happiness.
Now we could pedal into battle like the neon yellow warriors of old. We took the side streets and side walks, using the columns of smoke in the hills to guide our way. With Highway 24 closed, traffic was snarled everywhere. Angry drivers honking and yelling and threatening violence. I was tempted to tell them that if they really wanted a fight, they could just follow us. We could use a few thousand angry commuters on our side. As we passed the Rock Ridge BART station, we spotted the first enemy troops. Pandai patrolled the elevated platform, with furry black gears folded around themselves like firefighter turnout coats, and flathead axes in their hands. Fire trucks were parked along College Avenue, their lights strobing in the underpass. More faux firefighter Pandai guarded the station doors, turning away mortals. I hoped the real firefighters were okay, because firefighters are important, and also because they are hot. And know that